So, OpenSim is sort of a collection of modules. We have a small core framework that is the absolute standard that everyone who is working on OpenSim complies to. On top of that, we have a series of default modules that we have built for standard implementations of things. For example, the Second Life protocol library is a module that's part of OpenSim. Or we've got things such as trivial items, such as where the sun position is, that is handled through a module, chat, instant messaging, etc. The goal of our design here has been to allow various groups to take OpenSim and replace and customize those modules to their own personal uses and still be able to interoperate with the other modules developed by other people. OpenSim has several versions or flavors available, a bit like Linux distributions, which are collections of maybe some proprietary and some open source modules. 3DI, which was a company that Adam Johnston worked with up until recently, he's started a split-off company to work on OpenSim, officially has their own version of OpenSim that they provide for corporate users. RealExtend is a version of OpenSim with some extra models to handle their 3D mesh support. I work on, personally, a version of OpenSim designed for live music and media events where you need to scale up and down the number of instances that you have. The keys with OpenSim is that it's easy to develop. There is a very wide feature range. It's also licensed in a very friendly manner. We use the new BSD license, which is effectively a public domain license. You can take all of our code, you could resell it just as it is if you want, you can customize it, you can integrate it with proprietary components, you can integrate it with open source components, and you can still use the combined whole in a legally safe manner. Part of our project has been that we are very careful with our licensing. We make sure that we can provide OpenSim under the most flexible terms available. Do you want to continue on with anything?
Basically, yeah. I mean, it's
yeah. I'll try to get some screenshots up.
It's very general purpose, and I think the idea is that it's kind of aiming towards being kind of the Apache of virtual worlds. Basically, I mean, you can just add modules and applications on top of it to use it for whatever you want to do. Very flexible in that way, and we also recently started an Open Viewer project as well, which is a from scratch 3D viewer that's right now compatible with Second Life protocol, and that's very early in stages right now. So
okay.
About it,
yeah. So I'm just gonna get some screenshots up just as soon as this loads. Yeah. We've also got this complementary product, which Adam Johnson has mentioned, called Open Viewer. The goal is to develop a standards agnostic viewer project. OpenSim, our key is to make it fairly flexible so we can connect to any standards that are published. We're working with Linden Lab on the architecture working group to make sure that you can connect an OpenSim to Second Life 6 or 12 months down the road. We are also very keen to work with any other standards bodies to make sure that we've got a module that supports that standard. We are absolutely willing to work with any company that comes forward and is willing to contribute and work with the project. We like to feel that we're a fairly inclusive project that anyone can come and get involved with. I'll just put some screenshots. There's a folder called screenshots in there. Yeah.
I would wonder if actually we could hand round a sheet of questions, people who want to be questions, ask questions and put an order on it, because then I can be sitting here and try and moderate some of these questions. But has anyone got a loose leaf they can just hand around, pass around while we're doing this? Because we have about half an hour plus left. And I know some people want to say some things, but if you can just like put your name and on a list.
Can I ask a question specific to...
Yes, why not while we're doing this? Do absolutely.
The Second Life protocol,
yep.
I'd like you guys to talk about that a bit more, because what I typically see in some virtual world platforms is monolithic systems where the viewer is stuck to the server.
Right.
And the reason that the web became so successful is you can make a web server that works with any browser because you've got HTTP between them. So the question is, since you're already starting to mix and match servers and browsers, is the protocol you're using the right protocol to be that standard that allows innovation separately?
Honestly, I say no. Right now, there's unfortunately a dearth of protocol standards available. Some of the work going on right now is towards developing a good standard protocol that we can deal with. Parts of the current Second Life protocol, if I can be a little bit harsh here, need work. They have high... well. significant problems when accessing in high packet loss environments, such as wireless connections. The protocol can be obtuse. It's not clean to read. I think a newer protocol would use certainly some of the good things that Second Life's protocol has. It uses UDP in certain places, which make a lot of sense, but it also doesn't use TCP in places where that would make sense. It uses UDP only, except for the new bits which are coming in via HTTP. I think that a new standard is a good idea, and it's something that we would be very keen to work on. I think there's already been some interest from some of our developers to developing a new standard protocol, something that's a bit more interesting. That being said, however, the way we have this structured is we have a section of the code which is one of these types of modules called a client view, and each client view can represent one type of client. So that's one set of protocols for something. If you wanted a text-only interface to the world, you could write an IRC client view, and you could connect an IRC client in, and we would sort of understand what that meant. So we've got the ability to prototype new protocols very quickly. The counterpart is we need a viewer developed. Our project has been, up until fairly recently, I'd say we probably still have this heavy focus on just the server. Our goal is to build an absolutely fantastic server platform that can be used as a base for anything. We don't want to get bogged down into developing a viewer at the same time, because that's going to split resources off that we could be working on a scalable platform. So does that answer your question?
I also wanted to jump in for a moment and mention on the protocol side. I mean, one of the things we're doing in the architecture working group, and for those who don't know me, David Levine in World Jottery, is we're chasing from stepwise refinements
and
one of the things that I want everything to close down in UDP and that gets to all sorts of things. If the packet loss rate goes over that 1%, things permanently get bad on your client until you do horrible things, and we all know that. As we do that, we're trying to do the industry standards, so you'll hear a lot of phrases like REST and questioning about whether HTTP fits in the spot and so on. So I think anyone who looks at it will say, is the protocol right? Not entirely, and especially not at the low level, and it's evolved over the past 6 years almost now of coding, and where it is, and changing it is going to be painful, and it's got to be something we do carefully in the sense that nobody wants to break compatibility across the world as we do. We had a discussion about 6 months ago when Lyndon was looking at doing changes to login, but how to do that without breaking the open source community. We want to keep those stepwise refinements in mind, but anybody who thinks the protocol is going to look like it looks today in 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, 18 months is probably sadly mistaken. And if they think this protocol as it looks today is going to become a standard, they're certainly sadly mistaken. I would take that to OASIS or the IETF, only if I came in a tank.
We're going to move on to do a short, specific sort of look at these platforms, but I want a show of hands of anyone who was dying to ask a question and didn't get to ask a question in this phase.
Just to, for reference, this is the event that we built in 24 hours yesterday. So I'll just leave this running.
So you want to quick, we're going to hold them for like 5 minutes and then we're going to come back to them, but show of hands again and I'll come back to you. Okay. So perhaps you can...
Yeah, so actually since we're demoing on the floor, I think in the interest of time, why don't I suggest anyone who would like a more in-depth view of this, come visit us, who can see the live thing.
Sounds great.
And then we'll just, I'll pass it on to Nicole.
Okay. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the audio features built into Wonderland. So we've designed Wonderland specifically for people who are interested in business and education collaboration. We're looking at enterprise users, people who want to build virtual worlds behind their firewall. And one of the things that we think is really important is audio communication. And in fact, our group, before we started working on this project, we've been working on Wonderland for just over a year. And prior to that, our group focused on audio conferencing. So we have a lot of background in doing audio, and we've actually done a study on high-fidelity audio conferencing. So most audio conferencing takes place at 8K at telephone quality, but our VoiceBridge is capable of going up to CD quality. And we looked at what were the advantages of using high-fidelity audio, and we found some interesting things, like it's much easier for people to understand accented speech at higher fidelities. The combination of high fidelity and stereo makes it easier to distinguish voices that are similar. It's much better if you have a mixed reality situation where you have people in a conference room. If you can capture the audio in stereo, it helps the people who are listening even on lower bandwidth connections, lower fidelity connections. So in Wonderland, we've put a real focus on audio, sort of audio and the application sharing. But since the audio is kind of unique, I thought I'd talk about it. So we can dial down fidelity, so in a single session, you can have some people connected at 8K and some people at DD quality, depending on whether they're connected on the intranet or they're at home on a cable modem. So that's interesting. We've done some things to enhance meetings, so that, for example, we have an in-world microphone, so you can place a microphone anywhere, and there's a little pad that you stand on, and as soon as you stand on the pad, it amplifies your voice to fill the room. So that allows people to have private or sidebar conversations sort of in the back of the room, while the person who's standing on the microphone pad can be heard by everyone. We also have had a little fun with building a cone of silence, so that if you want to have a private voice conversation, you can just bring a couple people and walk into the cone, and that's a private area. So the VoiceBridge supports multiple simultaneous private chats or multiple simultaneous public chats, and that's where we're experimenting with user interfaces for that. In our work setting, we've done a lot of studying of distributed meetings, and one thing we know about our own work population is that people are very mobile. And if people on your team that you're meeting with are traveling, they might not have access to a computer, they might be driving in the car, whatever. And you can't tell team members for a real business meeting, sorry, you can't attend the meeting because you can't get into the virtual world. So we have a principle of graceful adaptation where we want to adapt to different devices. And so we've done extensive telephone integration with the world. And I'm going to play the video.
Oh,
that's your cue.
Okay.
Sorry.
I thought you were familiar with the video.
Oh, okay. That was you. So while she's setting that up, the idea here is that in the world, you can either you can dial in to a world, or you can dial out. So if you want to add somebody who you know is traveling, you can call out to them, or if you want, if somebody wants to be able to call into a space, they can do that.
This one, right?
It's the phone one. No, that's the old one. That's the other one.
How hard would it be to integrate your voice stuff with
open? Actually, I don't know exactly the details, but it's an open source project. It's all 100% Java, so it's a completely software-based thing. And then in order to integrate with the telephone network.
I'm not saying. Okay.
Takes one solid.
Yeah. So in order to integrate with the telephone network, you need some kind of a gateway, a voice over IP to PBX gateway. Most corporations have those already. Most corporations are doing some amount of voice over IP for their telephone transmission. So we just hook into our corporate gateway.
Hello.
Whoops.
Hey John, are you ready to join?
John, do you wanna?
Yeah, sure. Okay.
And we're all based on Android,
so you can use
any kind of software as well. Yeah.
It's already something we're working on, so Apple Ads. Yeah. So our VoiceBridge is all fit-based.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, play the video.
When conducting business meetings or classes in world, it's important to be able to include everyone who should be participating, even if some of those people do not have access to a computer.
But you're not going to be coming in.
Hey, Joe.
Hi, Nicole. We already have a couple of people on the phone. I told John we'd give him a call when he arrived.
Okay. So to call John, I click on the in-world telephone, and for his name and his number.
Yeah,
and
going
now
that is not...
Hello?
Hey John, are you ready to join our meeting?
Oh sure.
Okay, I'm going to join you to the world. Okay. When I add John, his orb shows up to indicate that he's now in our meeting.
So the orbs are the telephone users.
Where are you working today?
Oh hi Joe.
This is the customer service. I pulled up in one of their lounge areas.
So during the meeting, if I want to have a private conversation with John, I can click on his orb and then click on the take icon and take him with me. Now we can go off and find a quiet place to talk.
Okay, well, Nicole and John or talking, I'd like to begin our
So he can be having the meeting
yeah.
can go on, I can go
when
off.
When we're done, you might bring me over to Chris and Jeff?
Sure, I'd be happy to do that.
Yeah.
I can walk anywhere in the world taking John with me. We can either talk privately, or we can join another conversation.
No,
Here's
they can
Chris
hear it.
And Jeff, and I'm going to leave you to talk to them.
Right, thanks.
We could make it private. So I've just dropped
so
the orb off, so he can
orb.
Now talk to them.
And now John can have a conversation with Chris.
Can it take many orbs at a time?
Yep.
Hey, John, do you have a moment to talk about architecture?
In Wonderland, not only can tell us what
you can, yeah. that's it. Anyway, so that gives you a little bit of an idea. So we're trying to make telephone users sort of first-class users in the virtual world, and eventually we'd like to have a UI on the phone so that the telephone user themselves can navigate around and see who can hear them. I'm sorry.
Accessibility,
yeah. Well, for people traveling and for...
Right, multiple
yeah,
use.
Yeah, multiple use. Coming soon. Yeah.
Are you going to just also to initiate the proximity ad hoc conversation? The in-world proximity conversation to go on.
Oh, that's all voice over IP. Yeah. You want to answer?
That's right. All the audio communication is done through SIP. We're not using SIP for presence or anything like that in the application right now.
But all the audio is done using SIP.
I don't think SIP has any idea of 3D space.
No, that's accessible in the right way.
Is it only for the telephone part, or is it
no.
across the board for all the audio?
Across the board.
Okay, so Yanni, do you want to talk a little bit about avatars?
Yeah, sure. Maybe you can show the video.
Maybe.
We're really stressing.
We weren't. Yes, I have to say, just a disclaimer here. We this room is not supposed to be a media enabled. It's supposed to be a round table discussion where we sit round a table. And I lugged this monitor in on a skateboard. Did not know I was going to be sitting here doing this, but. Sort of working now. Where did your video go?
Okay.
You start talking, I'll look for the video.
We, in real extent, we see that to make really successful virtual world platform, you need to have every part of it working, like performance, visual quality, and the sound quality, and everything. But we are kind of giving some kind of extended real attention to this avatar, because it seems to be a key part for people. They love to edit their avatars in Second Life and in other worlds as well. They really spend money to do that, and it's a really important if you think about meetings, to see who you are talking with. And for all these purposes, we have now we have ongoing project inside Real Extent, where we are doing inverse kinematics.
So you want to
okay, let's look at the video here. This is done all in Real Extent.
Is it?
And it's
You're
it was just
it?
Yesterday.
You're getting
ready.
Sound? What's the sound?
It's coming. I think it took something like 2 man months to do it all together, all the environment and everything. But I think we're going to use that environment for something else than this 1 minute video. Otherwise, it was quite expensive video. And okay, about the avatar. We are concentrating on many things now with avatar. And one of those is cloud physics, real cloud physics, that they're going to have clouds that are, if you move, they move with you in a real way, and they don't clip with your hands or other things. And then we are going to do inverse kinematics. I don't know if you're familiar about that, but it's so that when you walk, your feet are kind of stick in the ground like normal persons do. They don't slip there. And when you do some animation like open a door, now using current technique, you play back that animation on an avatar. So you need to stand on the exact position so that your hand reaches the doorknob. But with inverse kinematics, your avatar can reach to the door wherever it is and do the animation based on that. And the inverse kinematics calculate your hand position, all the joints in the right places. So that's one thing we are doing now. And then we are going to do for meetings software that you can use a web camera that shoots your face and takes all the critical points like where your lips are and your eyebrows, and then move them according to your real face in the avatar itself. So for, let's say, in business meetings, this is really a critical thing. You can see what people think and do with their face, and also the head movement comes from there. So that makes it really.
So you're not
lovely.
You're not mapping the video. You're using it as a sensor. The
yeah.
Video is a sensor.
Yeah. Right, we're using video as a sensor, so you don't really see the actual another person there, but just the avatar.
And this is the real extent based on the Second Life?
Yeah. We have, we didn't take the Second Life avatar, we just completely built it from the scratch.
Right.
Yeah, the avatar thing, and now it's overlaid.
You use a standard webcam though to capture the video, and then there's
Yeah, standard webcam. We are in the process of doing that. We haven't yet managed to do it. But the cloud physics is now just now under work, and it's becoming quite so.
I tell you that blended animation in IK is a really cool thing, and it's also a really hard problem. I would love to see some progress on that. It's got to be one of the things in the next world. We always thought we could pull up the blended. We always thought that we wanted to do that from the very beginning. It's a daunting problem, of course, because you're simultaneously having to use the animation and world as a kind of a mechanical guide to move what is essentially
right.
A mechanical hand. And the problem is there's a lot of corner cases where trying to do that with an animation kind of won't work. You know, in the same way that you can't, you know, break your arm, you can't put it anywhere. You run into this interesting problem, but I have to say that I think that's a great piece of work to be trying to do, because it's one of the, in my personal design opinion, it's one of the key elements of believability that the avatar lacks today, is that we essentially have this odd situation where we have a little bit of physics going on, the avatar bumping into things and getting up on a table, and then all the animations are happening without any respect for the kinetics of the environment. So it's a very hard problem, and I'd love to see them work with that.
Yeah, I mean, that's
we would love to be working on it ourselves. You know, we're 250 people, and that seems like a lot of code.
What we're doing, as you know, is trying to use AI to control avatars as well as pets and so forth. I mean, we've run it up constantly against the fundamental lameness of just having a fixed set of animations for
yeah.
Each guy. I mean, we'd rather for AI take a more robotic type approach where, like, you can learn to grab something with your fingers in a different way depending on what shape of object it is, rather than having like a grab animation or even a grab one, grab two, and grab three animation.
Right. Actually, we could do it in a way that the door handle knows the animation that should be played.
Of course, the other challenge you have to face, and this is true of a number of the other features here today, is that they run into severe computational complexity problems without really sophisticated solutions around level of detail. The problem with blended animation in IK is that the computational cost generally of doing that, even for a single avatar historically, is like noticeable, significant amount of your
right.
So if you had 30 avatars breakdancing and bumping into each other, it's not computationally tractable
right,
to do that today.
Bring
so
the, physics simulation on the client you're asking the question of how much of that world am I transferring down the bounding boxes and how much of the calculation
yeah, but even
is getting
I'm
in the way of rendering.
Saying, even if you have a finite model that's
right.
all established in the client and you're just trying to bump the avatars into each other,
it's costly.
You're done.
You're done there, but even worse, because you can't just do that. You also have to now bring the physics models down and keep it coherent with the simulators.
Well, yeah, like we've used the IK library from the University of Pennsylvania, which is Indra's Kinematic IK. It's just for an arm, right? And just solving all those nonlinear differential equations for the arm consumes significant CPU. And you get a bunch of guys with a bunch of arms. I mean, if you assume they've got a powerful GPU on their client machine, you can do it. So
it'll be done, though. It'll be done. I mean, it's soluble by breaking it down into a finite method or a lattice method or something. There's a bunch of smart thinking about it. I'm just saying it's a great thing to work on.
Yeah, it's a big challenge for us. And I'm not saying that we will solve it once and for all, but we will take first step here.
Ben Driscoll from World of Medicine. We're an AI company doing AI for the world. Starting out with our virtual pets and multiverse.
So, do you want to
cool. Well, I'm thinking it might be best to just go to questions because we're running out of
yes.
time.
Okay. So we're open floor. You can. It's open floor. Everyone feels there's enough information.
My name is Yesha. I'm working on a long-term, more official standardization effort out of Europe. We've got something called MPEG-V for visual. So that I'm long-term. Question to the open standardized. What are we doing with money and time?
Well, this question keeps coming up, and this is perhaps a good question to come up because effectively a lot of these virtual worlds, you want to make money out of them. You want to be the Amazon where you can sell this. The problem is the money shouldn't be part of the protocol itself. If you look at it at a fundamental level on the web today, you do not have something in there that handles just Visa transactions. So we could put Visa transactions in the HTTP specification, and then suddenly everyone's got to use Visa for every transaction. And the same thing applies to virtual worlds. There is no reason to embed a payment processing method into the protocol itself. You can make sure that the protocol is extensible so you can do things on top of it, but I think that it's fundamental that you allow people like PayPal to spring up and satisfy the niche and allow competition to occur, because if you standardize these things too strictly, then you're going to run into edge cases where you won't be able to do this or this without running up to walls. We are not too keen on developing a money standard for a virtual world. What we're keen to do is to develop a virtual world server that handles a 3D simulation and has a very finite goal. I think a lot of problems with virtual worlds is they try and do everything. You want to do this. The fact is you don't need to solve everything. You can solve just what needs to be done to allow other people to solve every other problem. So. My answer is we're not going to touch money. We've got support in the server software for adding a currency module if you want to, so you can write a module to extend and do that, but we won't do it ourselves.
Yeah. Not just the money or PayPal, but
yep.
It has to do with permission, it has to do with obfuscation of the objects so people cannot copy it.
I'm going to get onto this one and say that any obfuscation of an object is rubbish, because at some point you've got to have display it on the viewer. All the viewers that we work with at the moment are open source, and if you're going to have obfuscation, someone can just look at the viewer code and say, well, hey, this is how it's being obfuscated, or they could grab it off the video card where it has to be decoded. There is no way you can display a encrypted or obfuscated object on a video card. There's no way you can do it.
Philip?
Yep.
On the video card, it's acceptable.
Yeah.
And if the rendering is being done in an open source client, it's acceptable. However, that said, marking intent, marking the creator's
yes.
intent, and supporting that is of the essence. So from the interoperability point of view, we've got to be able to say, this object was created by so-and-so, they've attached these Creative Commons or equivalent licensing terms to it. And if you violate them, you now are on notice you're stealing their item.
Yeah.
We can't technically stop them. There are limits there.
You know, a couple of high-level points about profit, money, and commissions, inventory, interchange. One of the reasons why we, and I think it's somewhat mystifying sometimes why we at Linden have been so proactive, to people that understand, and not like people in this room, but people that understand less about how virtual worlds work, this is such an interesting example of how, why would we at Linden so aggressively try to open source all our code and participate so actively with open source projects when indeed it would seem that we would lose the ability to make money as a business at all in the presence of a lot of different open source products? Well, that's the answer, actually. Because there's going to be enough people, not everybody, not every simulator wants to have these capabilities, nor will need it. But yeah, if you're going to sell a virtual pet, a virtual world, and you want to take it somewhere, or you want to have it be able to pay for it at all, you're going to have to use some sort of a single global mechanism for that, because otherwise it'll just become, you don't have to use one, but it'll just become inconvenient for you to say move money around between worlds. So I agree that the money should be separate from the system. And it's an interesting point, because this is one of the ways that we as a company have been smart in thinking about the strategy here and realizing that there will be reasonable ways for us to charge fees for things like money systems and inventory permissions. And of course, it's not just obfuscation, it's simply demarking that this was made by Amy Weber.
Yep.
You'll only trust that the clothes you're wearing were made by Amy Weber if you care. If there's some sort of a common naming scheme that says Amy Weber. And what our hope as a company is to provide those types of global services and make money on them, or at least some money in the marketplace. And we're so sure, having thought about it, that we can reasonably do that. It has allowed us to take the mission, the principal position, which we're very happy with, that we as a company can do that which will move the virtual world forward for everyone fastest, which is allow basically protocols, code, and everything else to be out in the open. And this is the stuff you guys are talking about, the amazing stuff that we're not working on. Fantastic. And still make money. Hopefully a lot of money. We're making a lot of money today as a company. So, I mean, we've done well thus far, although admittedly it's been by hosting these servers.
Right, but I think that this is of the essence. Part of that success comes from having the content created by users and respecting their desires to do that in an economically satisfying way. And one of the things that I try to take to the interoperability discussion is, how do we do interoperability so that at the end of the day, the people who are creating the content that makes this a special world, in some ways that's one of the things that Second Life is visually unique by, are feeling safe and whole and protected, that they can mark their content, and they have some reason to believe that it's not all being leaked out into the world instantaneously because they're attacking through an open source work. That's a really challenging thing, because the fact is, as Adam points out, there's nothing we can do to prevent the client from seeing the texture. Once you give the texture to somebody, they put it on your shirt's in world, it's going on to somebody's client, and they're actually going to view it.
But one point, though, that's also important to make about this is, Amazon.com has a really big website. Can someone in here just copy that Amazon thing and put it on your laptop so you can run around Amazon? No. You know why not? Because that Amazon stuff is connected to a bunch of back-end code that you can't just resource. There's always protection. This is the way the world works. The stack of intellectual property protection moves upward, hopefully at the speed at which horizontal ubiquity makes it unnecessary to have uniqueness there. And people start building property at higher levels. Animals, Ben's working on these animals in Second Life. You think you can just rip one of those off by pulling it out of the frame buffer?
Right.
Not a
living animal. In that case, would be, for example, a behavior or the ability to learn. And yet, to steal a certain number of units of server time for pet learning and intelligence. It's just unless you're building an AI system, it's more work than most end users.
And you guys don't have to. It's your choice. You don't have to expose the code that is behind these pets, either as scripts or as backend technology.
That's
elective as to whether you expose that code.
Right. That does raise one important point, though.
If we expose that code, I don't think that, and we're not quite sure to what extent we will, but that, even that, I don't believe is fatal to our business model whatsoever, because most of the value is in the knowledge that's taught to the virtual pets and AI, rather than in the source code itself. Anyway, the knowledge is in what people have taught to the AI, but it's in the knowledge base on the AI server, rather than the AI source code.
Yeah, I
just to make a point here on this, though. some things will be rippable. Take, for instance, looking on the web today. If you upload a script to your web host has a copy of that script. They can rip it. Likewise, if you have, say, sell something like vBulletin, it's a forum software that's used on a lot of websites. If you sell that software to someone, then you're giving them the code. And the moment you give them the code, then it's out of bounds. The solution to be able to protect something exclusively that relies on a server backend component is to host it yourself and provide it as a software as a service model. If you sell the object and you allow it to be transferred from one server to another, then at that point the people who it's been transferred to can copy it. And this is just the fundamental thing. If someone's got to copy something, they can make another copy. Yeah.
I actually have a question for, this comes from someone from EMC who couldn't be here, and this is for Sun and Quack, and it fits with this conversation, because this conversation is all about assets, and of course this group has a conversation about assets, because Second Life has this huge, you know, probably the richest storehouse of artistic creation in the world at this point. So the question from EMC, because you're, you know, this is a serious business question, he thinks that actually how assets get built up, and he actually, because he's not as up on this debate that they're into here, he asked it for all the panel, how are assets going to be built up in your world? And he thinks that's really the number one question for business, that he doesn't want to get involved with developer assets, the developers building assets.
Yeah, I think there's a number of approaches. So one of the approaches that we've taken with this is we try to be neutral to the notion of assets. So Quack is a sort of a different deployment model. Intrinsic, all of our environments are private licensed ones. So there's much less common bleed over in the typical Quack environment. But our view on this one is to make it easy for people to bring assets in and out of the Quack environment. So we don't have a Roach Motel sort of model where you check in but can't check out. So for example, if you bring a document into Quack, you can edify it, you know, modify it and edit it, take it back out. You're not stuck with it in. Likewise, if you create something in Quack, you can bring it out. We think generally that, you know, what we typically, because of our business focus, generally refer to this discussion as DRM, the digital rights management issue, is a key one. We see it today inhibiting the ecosystem for everyone generally, because people are reluctant to release IP without knowledge that this can be treated securely. And so our view on this one is really to say, what standard DRM or licensing schemes can we use to encourage third parties to create content which they can provide to others? So this notion of how do we license copies, I think, is sort of a key one that we see as well. We probably, just by virtue of the business focus we have, not as acutely on the point end of this issue as other people are. Intrinsically, most of the Quack activities occurs inside of confidential environments where the documents are highly confidential and where people often are not going to release them outside their firewall in the first place. So a lot of our value add is actually in complying with existing privacy domains that customers have. So we've always, from day one, been able to deploy a server behind someone's firewall. I mean, that's been sort of something we did way back when.
I think we're, you know, very aligned in that. We want to make sure that our open source platform is sort of agnostic to the content that anybody who can create. Kind of, we saw a lot of people on the show floor here who are selling avatar and avatar customization and warehouses for 3D objects. So we want to be able to take in, you know, stuff from Google, SketchUp warehouse and everything like that. So we want to try to build the environment so that we can take advantage of content. The other thing that's a little bit maybe unique about our environment is that we also see a lot of content getting generated programmatically or from feeds from the web and so forth. So a little bit more of a mashup type model of content. So not all content we don't believe in our environment is going to be like artist generated. But there'll be a lot more dynamic content, and that content will largely be also documents that people are working on and things like that. Less in the corporate environment and education, less about marketplaces and that sort of thing. People will use the environment for conferencing and other collaboration activities.
Yeah. Also, this is Peter Quirk from EMC. His question for the discussion we just had here about assets, you know, working with this wonderful artistic situation that's developed in Second Life and
is, you know, hopefully going to be interoperable with OpenSIM and will extend. His question is, what is your plan to, you know, make sure you stay interoperable and that you're, that you remain compatible and that you're not forking? He actually is quite specific. He felt LSL is already forking from the Second Life LSL.
Well, that's actually probably a good point. I mean, we have extended LSL. We've added, we've probably got something that we actually renamed it from LSL to OSSL. And the reason for that was we started adding new things. We added a lot more commands to start with. Then we started changing the syntax, adding things like switch statements, etc., that people have been requesting for years. We still are compatible with LSL, though. If you take any LSL script on the grid, it should compile under OpenSIM. Some of the back-end functions, LSL's got about 327 functions. I think we've implemented about 118 of those. So as long as you're using those 118, then they'll run just fine. Once we finish the rest of them, then, yes, any LSL, we're compatible with LSL 2.0. On the other hand, if you use OSSL, then that's not backwards compatible with LSL. You can't take an OSSL script and push it back to Second Life. In most cases, I think some of them will be, because OSSL is a superset of LSL. We already do.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So if stuff's already compiled to Mono, then it's interoperable.
Right. The difference is just the extra functions and things.
It's a library discussion. I know Babbage is already having some fairly rich discussions with OpenSIM developers.
Yes.
Things like, should we share some of the Mono libraries?
Yeah.
At some point.
Yes. You know, we've had
why do that work twice at some very real level?
Yeah.
Coherence and nice discussion.
Yeah.
Okay. I just wanted to say something about content and real extent. We as Real Extend, we see in the future, or we hope and see, that there are going to be many Real Extend servers around the world. Like today there are Apache servers, and each of those worlds need content on them. So that's a problem. Where I get initial content to populate the world, to make it look like something. And we have started to donate all our content that we do in the project to public use, and it's this CC license attribution only corresponds to BSD license on the code side, so that you can take and use. And I haven't yet seen any, or at least I don't know any good open source project around kind of open content projects, which we could have.
It's an interesting point. There is the Google warehouse. That would be a fantastic thing to integrate, so you could drag and drop items from there, and they're all in Collada. And there's also commercial services. TurboSquid is a fantastic one. I know there's some guys hanging around from them at this conference, but I think there are big libraries available. The key is just using standard formats, so it's using Collada or using some sort of common mesh format. We can use
those. In the open sort of space, like that might develop, the Clever Zebras and several other groups doing content intentionally for in-world with OpenGIS, so there could be a big discussion there.
Right, and we have a big
issue about the ratio of free and not free content. We've made a statistical assessment of that before, which is rather interesting. I can't remember the number. I'm looking at that. I can't remember the number last time we did this, but there was a double-digit percentage of items in Second Life that were appear to be sort of fully promiscuous with respect to permissions. People were okay with them being copied. And so it's interesting to note like what mass of content that is. Within a given sort of society, if you will, of users, you're going to sort of have an equilibrium point according to how much stuff people are fine giving away and then how much stuff they want to take and monetize. And if you can do both things in Second Life, it's interesting to look at how that number nets out. You know, the total volume of content, I think, is a significant driver of experiences, even behind the firewall experiences. You know, the stuff that we're doing with IBM is because we strongly believe that you really still want to be able to get content from the main grid or from somewhere quite easily, even if you're going to just do private business conferencing within a SIM. There's no question but that, I mean, no business right now is going to start from SAN in Second Life and build like a nice business conference. You're going to have to get content from somewhere. So whether it's from a system or not, you know, the sheer size of the content base in Second Life is interesting, you know, for comparison. It's about 1 billion assets at this point. It's about 100 terabytes of data. So it's a considerable amount of data. It probably makes the Google warehouse probably wouldn't be measurable within it at this point. So, you know, this is a big issue. And a lot of the experiences you have in Second Life, the reason they're cool is because they involve content that you probably haven't seen before. and that's the way it's going to be. And it's not just got to be visual content, it's got to be interactive content.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. You know, the most interesting content is actually living
here. And actually the point that you're on there about the fact that even though it's behind the firewall experience, it's exactly spot on. Nobody wants to have 500 avatars interact with 499 other companies. It's not going to do it. The N by M gets to you at about 5. And B, nobody wants to have to go recreate the 500 conference rooms that people seem to insist on creating, although why they don't want to sit by a lake and enjoy the view, I don't understand.
But there is not always the same lake,
but a waterfall and trees. And the point being that you don't want to create these little corporate walled gardens which are empty. You want to create corporate walled gardens which are lively and be able to say to people, okay, this part of the corporate walled garden not only is lively, but in fact is quasi-public. And those kinds of discussions are why it's not a simple standard like HTTP. It's not simply throwing content over the wall and forgetting about it.
About a third of those billion objects, by the way, as far as we can tell, are scripted. So, something like that. And actually, I think I'm talking about resident objects on the grid, so I'm not as sure about full object count containing the inventory. A lot of stuff.
A lot of code.
Sorry, going back to the original question, I think the idea is how do you remain compatible? I think because OpenSim is an open source project, there's always somebody around who can always come and say, oh, these, you know, revisions have gone apart a little bit and help bring them back.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
And there's a lot of a commercial interest in making sure things are compatible. I'm sure that when there's lots of installations around, say if it's the version that 3DI does, which is Jinsei, or it's the real extent server, the point is people are going to want to be able to go from one to the other, and the one which drifts too far apart and you can't do that anymore is going to be shunned a little bit until that's fixed. And there's a commercial incentive for people to have a compatible standard here. I think that's been probably the reason or driver behind why there's so many organizations now looking to standardize virtual world technologies. Well, I mean, that depends entirely on the content creators, whether they're willing to license their things to go outside the walled garden or not. If there are, then fantastic. That's great. They can nominate that.
It depends also on getting to a model in the protocol where we can mark whether or not the endpoint is the endpoint we trust.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
One of the challenges is going to be the trust model, because we want to be able to say to somebody, you can mark your content only staying on Linden's grid because that's the agreement you want, or on any trusted grid where there's a legal relationship that a DMCA request is going to be honored, or I don't care, I think it's a cool object, anyone can have it. We want to be able to get all those gradations. And again, we can't enforce them in the sense that, yes, some of the stuff is going to bleed, but we want to be able to know that the intent was conveyed all the way to the end.
It's an interesting point here, however, that I think there's a good commercial incentive for things to be more permissible. Take, say, someone's avatar. Someone's got a nice furry avatar that they go from one sim to another. Now, if you teleport from one region to another server that isn't trusted, your avatar's just going to disappear. And you're going to be pissed off at the creator of it, saying, well, hey, why can't you let me take my avatar with me? That's part of me. So I think that we'll see that there will be an incentive for people to start marking their items as transferable, because the customers are going to demand it. It gives value to your item and to your end user that they can use it.
Wouldn't there be an incentive for the landowner to have a certificate allowing that content on his land?
I mean, it certainly would. There will be models all over the place. I fully expect people to show up and say...
In fact, it's going to be an open ecosystem where we explore all these relationships. It's going to be essential, not just interesting, it's going to be essential. We're going to find out, this model really drives people to your content, this model drives people away. Mm-hmm. And I don't predict which one it will be. I've got some guesses, but let the market tell us. Yeah. Let people explore what happens when I create a wide open sim. Do I get a ton of user-created content and it's cool? Or does it turn into a weird wasteland? And I think... Predicting that is not only sort of
presumptuous,
but
sort of pointless. Catherine. Okay, there was a question.
Yeah.
Just before we take more questions, because it's a networking session now, so we can use the space as long as the next panel isn't waiting to get in. Is anyone here from the next one? Are you itching to get us off this table?
No, let's continue
this. Okay, so someone saw something that I missed.
Yeah.
Hi.
They may be interoperable, they may be open source, they may share, but they're all siloed. They don't throughout the currency, throughout the land office.
Right.
So what you then set the developer up to do is he has to endlessly create professional content for the consumer in the burn through.
It sounds like the internet today. To be honest, though, I think that... Well, there isn't going to be a single consistent... Well... That's each single one of those is a use case of this thing. There's also the corporate ones where you've got people who want to work. The case is that you have people conglomerate their regions into some sort of federation of sites. So you'll have website equivalents where you have big portals that set up that link website A to website B to website C. And that happens on the internet today. People conglomerate in certain locations. So, for instance, the dig.com virtual world would potentially be huge. It would be giant. It would be a massive collection of sub-sites which form something. Also, you'd have things like Second Life. Second Life is just one such use case for this environment. Second Life is a big virtual world where you've got people involved and they will exist. The key here is that you cannot just go to Second Life, though. You can go from Second Life to dig.com and back again. Yes, some of the experience will change. Some regions will, some environments will decide to be consistent in their visual scheme or other types of similarities, and yes, probably regions will group together based on similarities. I expect that to happen. But like the web today, there's nothing linking, say, one site to another. It's if they choose to make a link that joins them, then great, but there's nothing linking every single site in the net to every single other site in the net.
Well,
they didn't stick because obviously they
but
didn't get enough of a return from it.
So you have to say that that model does not work. Dropping in text-based internet websites
No, I mean, one of the reasons it doesn't work is because I would say the browsers at the moment aren't really set up to allow you to browse from one site to another. In Second Life, it's the browser is extremely limiting. You can't type in a URL and teleport from one area to another. You have to load up a SURL, which is a pain in the ass, or you need to open up the world map and find where you're going and then teleport to it, or you need to fly to it. There's nothing that gives you a convenience A to B link. Yeah?
What was that?
Oh, yeah, you can in the honor. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So, if we don't like the fact that there's one brand service that's responsible for all of the for some aggregate set of regions, make a whole distributed back and forth between multiple things, define a protocol between it, and you can do that right now. We were talking in the last about we don't even know the right questions to ask in many ways about what the standards are at this point. And these open source implementations are a great way to explore what the right set of standards should be and what the right behavior should be.
And I think one of the things which you've talked as a concern about a thousand simulators sort of flower is that we'll get a thousand simulators that are sort of half empty and uninteresting. I think the reality is that that's not going to happen because simulators are going to end up being run or not run based on whether or not people actually come there and play. And people are going to come and play because we create compelling spaces. If you look at virtual worlds that die, and there are plenty of them which are out there which are half dead, they're half dead because the users don't have a reason to hang around. And yeah, there are going to be some people who draw up a simulator in their garage because they think it's cool. And they'll play with it, and a dozen people will wander in and out, and it'll be like that web page you put up because you were born one Tuesday and you wanted to put pictures of your nephew up and you never updated it. And those die. Eventually somebody forgets to pay the domain name service registration and they go away. I think what's going to happen is going to be self-grouping. We're going to have large clusters of people who have a similar philosophy on content, and they're going to find ways to interoperate. And a lot of them, at least in the early going, are going to clearly hang off Second Life as an appropriate place to socialize and a place to get the large shopping situations happen, a lot of things are going to gradually coalesce. We have no good prediction for what that's going to look like, just like we didn't know which of the ISPs which were going to look promising in 1985, whether it was the AOL or CompuServe or Prodigy, mention a few ghosts, or Genie if you want to date yourself thoroughly. Bits of those models are still here with us today. You can still get an AOL.com email address, but lots of those went by the wayside when their content models stopped being relevant. And we'll figure that out over time.
Maybe it's not strictly open source topic oriented question, but just a curiosity question that anybody has thought on. Comparing to the web server model, web server model is one that's very price competitive, and you've got hosting providers that are competing with each other for lower rates and so forth. You go to eventually a future world where OpenSIM is working and there's lots of alternative sites, you're now on basically a hosting model that is radically different from the current model in Second Life, where you have a managed economy and sort of a relatively fixed land price, and where a lot of the value for people is in owning land or dealing with land. Although the reality, of course, is that whether you own or rent, you're paying rent, basically, which is a hosting model. But real estate values and currency values, in effect, are going to be radically changed. What do you think the impact of that is going to be as OpenSIM develops?
I think that you'll find that there'll be a very tiered relationship. For instance, say one web host allows you to use scripts and allows your scripts to consume 100% of a process at a time. That's going to be an expensive web host. Likewise, you're going to have environments which are going to be very cheap. They're not going to let you run scripts. They're going to let you have this many objects. They're going to let you use this many resources on things. You'll pay for more resources. Say you've got one world where every single blade of grass in the environment is physically simulated. That's going to happen on the server, and you're going to have to pay an expense for that. So you're going to find that all these web hosts are going to show up, and they're going to offer different competing feature sets. They're going to say, all right, well, I'll give you a really rich experience for end users, but you're going to pay out the nose for it. Or you'll have people who do the discount web host model. And to a degree, this happens on the internet today. You pay for extra database access. You pay for scripting access.
You pay for reliability.
Yeah, you pay for reliability of service.
And there are low-prem SIMs.
Yes.
Right. And the other piece that I think you're going to see is in terms of the social policy, you're going to find SIMs which say, everybody on this SIM is private. We're not going to identify them. You're going to find other ones where there's going to be a open ID requirement to log in, and every range of that. And that evolution, I think, is essential. It's like the internet. We'll toss out thousands of models over the next 10 years for the virtual world. And just like we suddenly will discover that Pointcast didn't work and why it didn't work, to pick on another old technology, some of them will fall by the wayside, and some of them are going to take off. And the exciting thing is having an ecosystem where we can explore that.
I just want to kind of wrap up by, thanking everyone here, particularly all the pioneers of open source, and thank you, Philip, for coming in, Ginsu, and thank you.
Thank you for organizing.
Yeah.
Yes,
thank you.
It was certainly
a roller coaster. God, I must have taken a photo of the graphic.
Very good, very interesting.
Sure, and then when everyone shows up with no appetite, and that shows
I sort of wanted to warn you more,
but I didn't want to make it.